Overall strategy was largely to do all it could to encourage people to grab the campaign and make it their own. It put out a call for people to organise and create circles, locally and online, to discuss the concerns they had and share ideas. Circles began to spark up all over the country. Eduardo Maura, part of the Podemos team working toward the elections, and Iglesias' fellow lecturer at Complutense University, called this the hacker logic of the movement. When you are doing politics as a hacker, you proliferate. You have to be everywhere. You want to be everywhere. This thinking drove their low-barrier, light-lift affiliation model, the polar opposite of most 20th-century political parties. They made connecting with the party as easy as possible. To create a branch, you only need a Facebook account, an email, and a meeting. No membership, no fees. So in the first 2 months, we got more than 300 branches, not only in different places, but also branches that had to do with specific fields like education, culture, the environment. There was a heavy emphasis on local agency in the way the circles were constructed. People were creating Podemos circles, not based on what the head office thought was important, but around the issues they cared about most. Podemos respected and understood the diffuse, fleeting, and untamable nature of a digital movement. The central figure of Iglesias and the central theme of injustice would guide their direction, but the energy was now broadly distributed. This strategy paid off. Five candidates, including Iglesias, became members of the European Parliament. Yet perhaps the bigger meaning of the win was as a demonstration of the party's political viability. The real-world victory validated all those citizens who had added their vote, their voice, or just their likes to the movement. A blended power party. By any measure, Podemos had arrived. But party leaders wanted to go much further, building on the mass participation they were known for by channeling citizens' energy into a structured approach to policy and decision-making. Their big idea was a 2-month-long citizens' assembly that would allow popular participation in the most important decisions. Through online and offline discussions, public meetings, and meetings of the circles, Podemos's goal was to crowdsource key aspects of its manifesto and policies and choose leaders. The process was a little cumbersome and uneven, but certainly very open. Anyone was welcome to submit drafts of their ideas. The Nation called it an unprecedented exercise of direct democracy, with over 100,000 people taking part. An online debating site, Plaza Podemos, launched, attracting 10,000 to 20,000 followers every day. A participation platform allowed people to fund the party's efforts, either through contributing to its general work, making microloans to back election campaigns, or supporting specific projects. For all of the new power involved in the process, it delivered something of an old power result. Iglesias's central role was solidified by his election as General Secretary, and his platform of proposals won the day. What's more, he successfully fought off a proposal that the party have 3 General Secretaries as a check against concentrated power at the top. More than ever, even after an extensive participatory process, he was the dominant face and leader of the movement. By December 2015, Podemos had built such strength and momentum that it ended up winning over 5 million votes and 69 seats in Spain's parliament. It had broken the country's 2-party rule before its second birthday. 4 months before the Indignados movement broke out, 2,000 miles away, Wael Gonim was launching his own assault on the establishment. He was an administrator of the We Are All Khaled Said Facebook page that sparked the Egyptian chapter in the Arab Spring. Yet this surge of new power, like the Indignados and Occupy movements, would dissipate. In Egypt, the unrest of the revolution presented opportunities for old power forces, more despotic than those they replaced, to grab control. As Gonim recalled in a 2015 TED Talk, "I once said, if you want to liberate a society, all you need is the internet. I was wrong." Gonim, looking back, believes that the distributed leadership and social networks of the Egyptian protest movement actually served to weaken rather than strengthen it. The euphoria faded, we failed to build consensus, and the political struggle led to intense polarization. Social media only amplified that state by facilitating the spread of misinformation, rumors, echo chambers, and hate speech. What Podemos teaches us is how to avoid the fate of Fizzle. Of all the organizations in this chapter, it began with the greatest ideological commitment to new power. Yet its success depended on constant pragmatism. They were careful not to be overly dazzled by the promise of social media, nor live on the adrenaline of protest alone. Founders were always willing to pivot to old power when the situation demanded. Podemos is not alone in successfully blending power to mount a political insurgency. In neighboring France, in 2017, Emmanuel Macron swept into office by launching a movement, En Marche, that very quickly transformed itself into a governing political party. He did this by skillfully exploiting dissatisfaction with establishment politics, rallying digital crowds, and marshalling mainstream media attention to build an organized political base in record time, something that would have been much harder to do in another era. Yet he did all this running as a fairly conventional centrist who has not embraced the Podemos brand of radical participatory politics. Of course, there are challenges inherent in the Podemos approach. We should always think twice when charismatic leaders claim to represent the voice of the people, and Podemos remains overly reliant on the force of Iglesias' personality. There is risk too, which Podemos is well aware of, that idealism in campaign mode will turn to entitlement and cynicism when it governs. Placards can be perfect. Policies never are. The party has seen successes, especially in its influence on cities, with mayors in Barcelona and Madrid emerging with the support of the Podemos movement. Yet its elected officials' early years in parliament have been made up of concessions, coalitions, squabbles and compromises, all set in the maelstrom of a new multi-party reality. But the party's initial achievement is undisputed. Spanish politics has changed, becoming younger, more plural, and more participatory as a result of its insurgency. And Podemos has created a model for a new kind of political party that the world needs. Those who master the skills we have laid out in this book will be able to shift between old and new power as situation and strategy demands, to flip from open to closed, to toggle between movement and institution, to know when to control and when to release control. There is urgency around this work. If we want to imagine a more positive and participatory politics, Podemos is instructive. The most important causes in the world, though they might bristle at the comparison, would advance their work further with the blending capacity of the NRA. Many of us understand how to speak old power. After all, that is the world we grew up in. Rising generations may have new power as their mother tongue. But those who really change the world will become fluent in both. Chapter 11. New Power at Work. Reuven Gorst, Global VP of Customer Strategy at SAP, told us a funny story about an intern he hired a couple of years ago. She did the job for 3 weeks, then mentioned in passing, "Oh, you know, I met Bill." Bill is the CEO of SAP. Reuven had worked there for 10 years and had never had a minute with him. "Oh, that's cool," said Reuven, studiedly nonchalant. "Well, I've got a meeting with him next week for a half hour." Reuven was a little flummoxed. What had just happened? His intern explained. "I came up to him and I said, 'I'd like to meet with you to give you feedback.' And he said, 'Fine,' and gave me a time." Many people have their own version of Reuven's story. Of all the challenges in the workplace, perhaps the most mystifying for the old power leader is the daily task of management in a world where many now have new power values. Younger workers, and others as well, are increasingly pushing back against norms like hierarchy, loyalty, and the very idea of the specialized professional who stays in her lane. Old power and new power are colliding in today's workplace. In the 20th century, the world of work was arranged according to the color of your collar. Blue-collar workers formed unions and fought and won basic rights and entitlements designed to protect them from the often insecure nature of their trades. White-collar workers were soldiers in the great march toward managerialism, a governing ideology seen everywhere from the League of Nations to Ford Motor Company to the Japanese company man. The role of the professional was to slot precisely into elaborately managed and ever larger organizations. In return for what would often be decades of steady service, he would steadily move up the ranks and be rewarded with job security and social status. Many of our old power leaders grew out of a world that prized those who fit well into a set process and organizational structure. Yet today, that exact skill can be seen as a major liability. In the 21st century, managerialism, as both ideology and practical reality, is under assault. Our cultural heroes are increasingly scrappy disruptors, not corporate managers. The efficiencies of managerialism are seen as sand in the wheels of innovation. Decades-loyal company men are being replaced by contingent and on-demand workers, and an amorphous maker culture is challenging long-standing norms about expertise. Old power managers are facing workplaces that can feel like they are full of wannabe Elon Musks with vastly higher expectations and unending demands for feedback, with one eye on their next promotion and the other on their next job. Too often, this tension gets lampooned as old codger versus young Turk, AARP versus ADD. But there is a deeper cultural shift playing out as old and new power values do battle at work. In this chapter, we'll unpack why new power workers are approaching the world so differently, and we'll suggest how managers can deliver the recognition, opportunities, and agency required to get the best from them, without losing their minds in the process. Not whining, but pleading. Why feedback and recognition now matter so much. Just imagine for a moment that your workplace functioned with the same dynamics and incentives as a social network like Instagram. In that world, an ordinary act, let's say submitting your expense report to your boss, would be met with some pretty extraordinary validation. Within seconds of hitting send on your report, you would receive dozens of comments from your colleagues saying how terrific your work was. You'd hear things like, OMG, that is amazing, so cool, great work. People would stop by your desk to smile at you and congratulate you on getting it in on time. Someone might even bring you a little heart-shaped sticker to wear on your shirt. Your boss would share copies of your expenses with everyone he knows with a note that says, hashtag must read. Throughout the day, you would enjoy a steady stream of praise as more and more people became enthralled by how much you'd spent on taxis and cappuccinos. You'd get notifications that say things like, Pradeep just read your amazing report. Your expenses wouldn't actually need to add up. After all, the only people assessing them would be those predisposed and hand-selected to affirm you, offering dose after dose of personalized delight. Contrast this experience with something that looks a lot more like reality. A 23-year-old assistant spends all weekend on a new marketing idea he has for his company. He is super excited about it and goes above and beyond to put together a slide deck that lays out his thinking. He emails it to his boss first thing Monday, and then he waits. On Wednesday, he sends a follow-up just to check she's received it. On Friday, he gets a note back apologizing, saying she's been at a conference and will get to it next week. The Thursday after that, she finally emails back saying, interesting, thanks for sharing. It is both easy and common to cast a new generation of workers as narcissists, whiny millennials, desperate to spend every moment talking about themselves and their feelings, and expecting a medal for doing so. But it is smarter to see these expectations as signals that the workplace has failed to create the satisfying feedback loops that have multiplied in other aspects of our lives. Research from the Young Entrepreneur Council shows that 80% of millennials would prefer to get feedback in real time. A 2014 Millennial Impact Report showed that more than half, 53%, of respondents said having their passions and talents recognized and addressed is their top reason for remaining at their current company. There is a reason that feedback and recognition are so highly prized by the new power set. For most, their lives are punctuated, perhaps even defined, by the validation and engagement of others. Every text, every image, every post is a call designed for a response, the drip, drip, drip of dopamine reward they receive from every heart-shaped like. Even their dating lives are adjudicated by strangers looking at carefully curated photos and deciding to swipe left or swipe right. Being judged in explicit and implicit ways is part of their lives. It is how they navigate, guided by a galaxy of digital North Stars that shape, encourage, and catalyze every move. Their lives are rich in data, too. They measure their steps, calories, heart rate, and sleep. Think of the experience the millennial worker has as he runs home from work using the Nike running app. He gets instant information on his speed and pace, dressed up with a nice map of the route ahead. He can get cheers from his Facebook community, who can track his progress in real time and applaud. He can compare his times with his previous times and those of his friends. Once he completes his run, his stats are posted to his community for their validation and admiration. Then, an Olympic gold medalist praises him via his Bluetooth headphones to tell him what a great job he's done. Believe it or not, there is now even wearable technology that monitors a person's energy levels in the bedroom. On completion, a mobile app offers you a score. Indeed, in our digital lives, we are increasingly conditioned to get badges and status upgrades for doing little more than showing up. One of Snapchat's core features is its trophy case, where you can display the trinkets you have been awarded for such Olympian feats as verified your email address in settings and sent a snap with one filter applied. Of course, for many young workers, this is the story not just of their digital lives, but also of their childhoods. They were raised as part of a trophy generation, recognized for the act of participation rather than the level of performance, getting medals and lavish praise just for completing the race. The parenting philosophy that governed their early years, build self-esteem above all, conspires to deliver the same artificial feedback loops as most social networks, persuading the individual that the ordinary moments of their lives are actually of extraordinary value. Those who enter the workplace with this mindset often find that reality bites hard, and so do their bosses. Emerging approaches are helping organizations meet this new power worker on her own terms. The online service, Tiny Pulse, is a user-friendly solution that asks employees one simple question each week. This provides two benefits. First, it offers an outlet for those expecting a chance to share their views. Second, it provides managers with regular doses of data that can be aggregated, analyzed, and, ideally, acted upon. Playful and friendly, the voice of Tiny Pulse sounds nothing like corporate speak. Questions like, if your company were an animal, what would it be and why? Line up next to, do you intend to be working here in 12 months? It is a far cry from the traditional staff survey that is rolled out annually and then disappears quietly into the graveyard that is the company intranet. And it only takes 2 minutes. It has been adopted by IBM, Facebook, and Airbnb, among others. When Henry experimented with Tiny Pulse at his organization, its Cheers for Peers feature really took off. A peer-to-peer digital recognition system, it lets everyone from the boss to the intern publicly recognize their colleagues for good work. Products like Tiny Pulse offer a hint of what is to come. Managers receiving and delivering feedback to new power workers in a way they're familiar with, drip, drip, drip style. But this is not to say that the burden is entirely on management. Those with a new power mindset need to recognize the big difference between their boss, who is there to help them grow and develop, and their followers, who are simply there to cheer them on. There is a big opportunity here. Having a workforce of people who want more feedback and agency is not something to be squandered. Note the opposite challenge in the old power workplace. Employees, especially those who have been undermanaged for years, who can view any kind of feedback as a criticism and an existential threat. The founder feeling, why almost everyone wants more agency and what to do about it. In 2015, MTV conducted a survey asking 1,000 young people born after the year 2000, the post-millennials, what they thought their new generation should be called. The winner? The Founders' Generation. It's an answer that tells us a lot. In a new power world, where people are increasingly skeptical of traditional institutions, the great professional myth of our time is of the disruptive founder who builds a vast, unlikely empire from scratch. The story of Evan Spiegel, co-founder of Snapchat, one of the most popular social networks for this emerging generation, offers a textbook example. In the first chapter of this familiar startup tale, Evan and two co-founders, Bobby Murphy and Reggie Brown, have their big idea. They will create a photo-sharing app that makes it fun to annotate and draw on photos. But with a catch, the photos will then disappear. This was an idea well-timed for a generation wrestling with the competing urges to protect their privacy and to send naughty pictures. Chapter 2 brings the obligatory dropping out from a prestigious university. Spiegel checks this box by abandoning Stanford University, only a few credits short of graduation, to pursue his Snapchat dream. He then shifts neatly into Chapter 3, a legal brouhaha with his co-founders, falling out with Brown, the guy who first had the idea. Brown sues him. Our story hits its climax in Chapter 4, when Spiegel gets approached by his entrepreneur hero, Mark Zuckerberg, who offers to buy Snapchat for $3 billion. But will Spiegel believe enough in his idea to reject his hero and risk it all? Hell yes. You know what happened next. Snapchat grows wildly. Spiegel thrives. The company goes public at a $24 billion valuation. Spiegel marries an Australian supermodel. Perhaps best of all, Spiegel gets to tell much older people what to do every day, the dream of any young person. As one former employee told Fast Company, he just wants people to listen and do what he's asking, and he's really getting sick of having to explain what Snapchat is to one old fart after another in the media industry. Is it any surprise the founder myth has such appeal? Of course, there's plenty of tinsel around Spiegel's founder narrative. Like Zuckerberg, he was born lucky, as he has noted himself. He grew up in the wealthy Pacific Palisades, the son of successful Harvard and Yale-educated lawyer parents, with all the confidence that being rich, highly educated, straight, white, and male confers in America. As has been well documented, that is precisely the founder profile that Silicon Valley tends to back again and again, in no small part because most venture capitalists are cut from the same cloth. Nonetheless, a generation of elites who would have previously coveted a partner-track job at Goldman Sachs or McKinsey are now fantasizing about launching their own machine learning startup called something like Splotchy. A Bentley University survey showed that 66% of millennials report they want to start their own businesses. Of course, only a small fraction of that number actually do, and the rest are the people whose founder-like expectations are upending the traditional workplace. More broadly, even if we don't dream of becoming a tech billionaire, we are now operating in a world where, across most facets of our lives, we're having founder-like experiences, as we are more and more the creators of our own myths, leaders of our own communities, stars of our own shows. New power dynamics make the desire for the founder feeling much more widespread. What does it mean to want to feel and act like founders, even if we work for someone else? To answer that, it is helpful to think through what founders actually do. Founders build things. Founders create something new. Simply overseeing or improving someone else's initiative is no prize. Their validation comes from what they create. Founders feel real ownership. For entrepreneurs, this means owning equity, and then being sued by your spurned co-founder if things go really well. In the new power workplace, it means a meaningful share in the value created by the organization. It also means getting to make your own decisions. When you're a founder, no middle managers are there to scold or micromanage you. Founders experience the joys and terrors of transparency. They know how much everyone is being paid, how much money is in the bank, whether the business paid its taxes on time. These are precisely the same kinds of demands we see from younger workers who increasingly feel entitled to the kind of information usually reserved for senior executives or even CEOs from full salary transparency on down. Founders do many jobs. When you're a startup founder, you don't have the luxury of doing just one highly specialized job. In the first year or two of your venture, you're probably doing everything from buying cleaning supplies to sales to putting together a new logo or website. This mirrors the increasing demands in today's workplaces for people to play roles that go far beyond their more narrowly defined job descriptions and to play across disciplines and skills. There's an excellent chance your new marketing hire is learning to code on her lunch break. It is the era of the side hustle. A recent survey showed that almost a third of millennials now have an extra job on the side. Founders are all in and always on. They benefit from greater flexibility and autonomy than 9-to-5ers, but the boundaries between their work and their lives tend to be blurry. Of course, there is a dark side to this founder feeling. The one part of the founder's experience that most people do not want to share, yet do, is the uncertainty and insecurity. The reality that 3 out of 4 venture capital-backed startups fail mirrors a workplace where people no longer feel secure in their roles and aren't seeing the kind of long-term commitment from employers that loyal employees could count on in the post-war era. Many are now searching for firmer ground. A survey by Manpower Group showed that job security was second only to money as the millennials' greatest motivation in choosing a role. All these desires and anxieties are placing great strains on the old power model, which delivers very little agency, information, engagement, and flexibility for the worker, who largely has to fall into line. But some organizations are successfully building this founder feeling into the fabric of their workers' daily experience. The pioneering Dutch network of home care nurses, known as Buurtzorg, for one, has given a new power makeover to a traditional profession. The Founding Sisters. How small and mighty teams of nurses are reimagining community healthcare. If you wanted to learn something about the future of the workplace, you probably wouldn't begin your quest by heading to the Netherlands and inquiring about the state of nursing. But Buurtzorg, a decentralized network of nurses who engage with their communities on their own terms, has shaken up the profession. Its story is a masterclass in how to scale that founder feeling and create a workplace built on new power principles. Buurtzorg began in 2006 with a vision of what nurses would not do. They would not be drowned in paperwork. They would not let strict procedure trump healthy culture. They would not be governed by out-of-touch paper pushers at HQ. Instead, they wanted to do the work that inspired them in the first place, caring for patients. They would connect with their community and make the decisions that mattered themselves. They would decide when and how to visit people in their homes, dealing with everything from changing bandages to making end-of-life plans. They will be in charge of their own world. This was not an original dream. Their list of hopes will be familiar to many who work in old power institutions and imagine a Jerry Maguire moment when they finally say, enough, stick it to the man, and blaze their own path forward. But Buurtzorg had a plan to go with the fantasy. To get community healthcare right, it would put all the power in the hands of small, self-directed teams of 10 to 12 nurses. Each team would take charge of the complete process of caring for their patients and for the running of their own small enterprise. They would make their own decisions, minimize administrative oversight, and be connected to the other teams via a shared technology platform, allowing all the nurses in the network to learn and work together. They'd be free to experiment with new and creative ways to deliver care. 10 years on, Buurtzorg has over 10,000 nurses in the Netherlands, operating in 850 teams, serving over 70,000 patients a year. To support all this, it has a back office of just 45 people. A KPMG study shows that its model delivers a 50% reduction in hours of care improved quality of care, and raised work satisfaction for their employees. Its overhead is much lower than the average. So are its sick leave rates. So is staff turnover. And Buurtzorg has been repeatedly scored as having the highest employee satisfaction among all Dutch companies with more than 1,000 employees. Its nurses are also achieving higher rates of patient satisfaction, even as they provide fewer care hours. With the patient at the centre of their mission, and with the removal of the heavy hand of bureaucracy, they get better results in less time. Their patients get their autonomy back more quickly, and have shorter stays in the hospital. Contrast this with the traditional role of the nurse who, across the world, feels under-resourced and unable to spend sufficient time to support her patients. Research by the International Council of Nurses and Pfizer showed that aggression against nurses is widespread, with a quarter or more in almost every country reporting workplace bullying by colleagues. This culture is costly. A 2015 survey by the Royal College of Nurses showed that almost a third of UK nurses are seeking a new job. What life is like at Buurtzorg, one founder's story. Madelon van Tilburg, a nurse for Buurtzorg based in Den Haag, isn't seeking a new job anytime soon. But if you met her, you might be struck by a sudden wish to quit your job, move to Holland, and become a home care nurse. She beams when she talks about her job, brimming with professional pride and purpose. It hasn't always been this way. She used to work in a corporatized home care organization that was obsessed with hierarchy and bureaucracy, targets and time slots. She was always rushing, clocking in and clocking out. She ended up being punished for spending too much time with her elderly patients, even when doing preventative care. I had this meeting with the same manager every week and she would say, "Oh, you work with Mrs. Brown. On Thursday, you went over 5 minutes longer than was estimated. Why was that?" As she explains, life at Buurtzorg is very different. When you start a new team, you have to find your own office. Setting up an office is the starting point of the team, because you have to find your place in a community and find your way around the community. It's also very good for building up your team. You're working together, you decorate it together, and your team decides who's going to find chairs, who's going to paint the walls, and all that. It really feels like your own business. You do it together, and then you have the common responsibility. That's very important. This might seem like a needless distraction, something that would be more efficiently provided as a shared service by a specialist at a head office. But asking nurses to own the whole startup process is a very intentional step. It is part of building a culture that feeds individual agency and builds collective bonds among the nurses. This culture continues in their daily operation. Like startup founders, the nurses on Madelon's team find themselves doing a bit of everything. Juggling nursing, making care plans, managing the office, hiring and firing, budgeting and connecting with the local doctors and hospitals. Sometimes you find out about new talents of your colleagues or about yourself. Someone might say, "Oh no, I don't want to do the planning, I'm no good at it." We'll say, "Just try it." And then maybe she'll find out that she really likes it and she's really good at it. Every member of the team can freely view its budget and billable hours, with help from Buurtzorg's own nurse-friendly software, which makes this transparent across the whole network. No one can question the motives of the boss, because management in each team is a shared responsibility. The teams are deliberately small enough that consensus-based decision-making is workable. The deep sense of ownership and collegiality Madelon feels produces the kind of job satisfaction that even the fanciest all-you-can-eat Google cafeteria lunch spread cannot buy. It also provides a foundation based in trust, transparency, and mutual accountability that enables her to focus on outcomes rather than just manage workplace politics or hit corporate targets imposed from the top down. Like any good startup founder, she sees her job as locating customer pain points and coming up with solutions in innovative ways. What is particularly surprising is that Madelon has developed this sense of ownership while being part of a much bigger organization, which usually tends to kill the founder feeling. but for a large company, Buurtzorg is remarkably flat. In place of six layers of management occupied by people with titles like Advice and Support Officer, Systems and Operations Management, it employs just 15 coaches across 850 teams to support and advise around any issues that come up. Coaches are typically more experienced nurses, not administrators or managers who have never been on the front lines. And they don't have management authority or hiring approval or veto rights, formally or informally. They're more like mentors and advisors. The fact that each is assigned 50 or 60 teams acts as a check on coaches becoming managers. Other than the coaches, the teams are left to get on with it. Buurtzorg's motto sums it all up. How do you manage professionals? You don't. Madelon's most vital piece of infrastructure is her access to all the other nurses. Buurtzorg Web is a kind of new power network that facilitates learning, peer support, and the development of shared resources across teams. It allows Madelon to confer with 10,000 other nurses if she has a question about a particular disease or a tricky patient situation. She can find a nurse with more expertise on a particular topic than she has, or someone in another region beyond the confines of her local team. Nurses share their knowledge by creating online courses for one another. Madelon has found the one on dementia especially helpful. This online community is much more vibrant than the usual corporate intranet, because in a world without managers, peer support becomes key to professional development and problem solving. In her old job, Madelon often used to hope that patients wouldn't ask her a question on the way out, knowing this would push her way over her allotted time quota. But at Buurtzorg, making time for a cup of coffee comes with the job. That can make all the difference, not just for her and her patient, but for health outcomes. Once people start talking, she finds truths and solutions often emerge. She proudly tells the story of one patient who started sharing her concerns about her 96-year-old neighbour, also a patient of Madelon's, and she offered to help. So Madelon recruited her to stop by next door at the end of each day to help the older woman remove her support stockings. This not only saved Madelon the task, but also added a little more glue to her community. What Buurtzorg gets right that Silicon Valley got wrong. An ocean and a continent away, another experiment with self-managing teams has taken place. Holacracy is a radical new management philosophy and system invented by software engineers that digital outfits like Zappos and Medium have been enthralled by in recent years. Zappos took it so much to heart that it restructured the entire company, eliminating bosses and departments altogether. On the surface, Holacracy appears very new power, offering a new way of running an organization that removes power from a management hierarchy and distributes it across clear roles, which can then be executed autonomously without a micromanaging boss. It boasts more flexible roles for staff and greater transparency. Holacracy might sound a lot like Buurtzorg, only with better software. It is far from it. In fact, the differences between the two models help us understand the real secret to Buurtzorg's success and what the rest of us might try to emulate. Nurses like Madelon and her teams have huge freedom to define their own working methods, while Holacracy is highly structured and directive, perhaps more so than many old power organizations. A sample instruction from the 40-page Holacracy Constitution reads, "As a partner assigned to a role, you have the authority to control and regulate each domain of your role. You may do this on a case-by-case basis when others request permission to impact one of your domains by considering the request and allowing or withholding permission. Restrictions and protocols, with a good sprinkle of jargon, become the focus under Holacracy, not the work itself." Medium abandoned Holacracy after initially embracing it with gusto, saying it was getting in the way of the work. And Holacracy is partly blamed for the departure of an unprecedented nearly one-third of the Zappos workforce in just 1 year, 2015, and for the companies being left off Fortune magazine's annual list of the best places to work for the first time in 8 years. Holacracy is like new power for robots. Julia Kulin describes her experience when a long-standing Viennese-based consulting firm, of which she was a managing partner, adopted Holacracy. It felt like being part of a code, an algorithm that is optimized for machines, but not for humans. Instead of feeling more whole, self-organized and more powerful, I felt trapped. The circles I was being part of did not feel empowering at all, but instead took away my natural authenticity as well as my feeling of aliveness. What Buitzorg gets so right is it puts human beings front and center. It focuses on how to get teams of people to form deep connections with one another, which is why they turn nurses into interior designers. Buitzorg uses technology to enable better peer coordination, but it doesn't lead with it, a lesson that holocrats, and some in Silicon Valley, have yet to learn. From Till Death Do Us Part to Friends with Benefits, How to Come to Grips with the Transient Worker. During the next year, if given the choice, one in four millennials would quit his or her current employer to join a new organization or to do something different. That figure increases to 44% when the time frame is expanded to 2 years. By the end of 2020, two of every three respondents hope to have moved on, while only 16% of millennials see themselves with their current employers a decade from now. Deloitte 2016, Future of the Workforce, Surveying People in 29 Countries. The CEO of a major company was recently doing a Q&A with a new class of interns. A feisty soul piped up, "Can you tell me about my opportunities for advancement?" "Advancement," thought the CEO. "We haven't even hired you yet." When you understand the draw of the founder feeling, it's no surprise that many workers at big organizations are increasingly impatient to move up or move on. Instead of resisting this, LinkedIn's co-founder and chairman, Reid Hoffman, has embraced it. Everyone who interviews there is asked a version of a question that the upwardly mobile intern would surely appreciate. What's the next job that you would like to have post-LinkedIn? For many old power thinkers, this is the professional equivalent of asking your brand new fiancé what she thinks your second wife should look like. But Hoffman wants to put a stop to what he sees as the biggest lie the workplace tells us. We are a family. We shouldn't think of our workplace commitment as we do our marriage vows, till death do us part. Instead, we should frame the employee-employer relationship as an alliance made up of short and clearly defined tours of duty that last 2 to 4 years. With Chris Yeh and Ben Casanoca, Hoffman wrote a great book on these ideas called The Alliance. Once each tour is complete, it will often be renewed, but sometimes it will see the employee move on with both sides better for it. It should come as no surprise that LinkedIn, the biggest career social network, arguably the platform that has done the most to collapse barriers for people wanting to improve their prospects and shift jobs, is trying to reimagine the social contract with its own employees. In doing so, it is addressing what is also a big challenge for the old power workplace. How to capture value from the many people who aren't looking to make a decades-long commitment to one employer. Here are some of the clauses from Hoffman's sample Statement of Alliance, which can be used by those embarking on a tour of duty. Consider how different this is from the for better for worse promises we implicitly demand from our new hires in the old power world. I want you to help transform the company. In return, I and the company need to help you improve your market value and transform your career, preferably within this organization. While I am not making a commitment to offer lifetime employment, and you are not making a commitment to stay for your entire career, we will act to maintain a long-term alliance even if the employment relationship ends. We, the company, expect this current tour of duty to encompass the time it takes for you to execute the following mission objective. I expect this tour of duty will last approximately the following amount of time. Here is what the results of a successful tour of duty look like for the company. Product launches, process improvements, sales, etc. Here is what the results of a successful tour of duty look like for you. Knowledge, skills, accomplishments, recognition, etc. What's more, once your tour of duty is over, your relationship with the company is not. LinkedIn wants its alums to refer people it should hire, act as ambassadors, share ideas, and help shape and protect the company reputation. Those organizations that want to build robust alumni networks will have to first make sure they are producing proud graduates whose loyalty will endure beyond their last paycheck. There is increasing risk today for organizations whose former employees are ready to rise up and speak out against them. One senior HR leader recently told us that the website Glassdoor, which displays anonymous and sometimes scathing company reviews from current and former employees, keeps her up at night and is now having a much greater influence on new hires than her company recruiting site ever did. The atomized and uncertain future of work. Not only are workers becoming more transient, work itself is becoming more atomized and impermanent. The contingent workforce is growing rapidly, thanks in part to the rise of gig economy platforms. In a world of fraying loyalties, tour of duty professionals, downsizing, wannabe founders, and hybrid musician, coder, furniture designers, up to 40% of the US workforce can now be counted as contingent. Some of this shift can be explained by the cultural dynamics we have laid out in this chapter, but much of it is also driven by hard economic realities. There are fewer well-paid, secure, full-time jobs up for grabs. The challenges of managing contingent and gig economy workers may be a glimpse into the future of management generally. If you're a company with a large share of contingent workers, or your business model is dependent on them, the tropes of traditional HR can seem rather quaint. The standard reviews and performance development plans that worked in the old power world don't make sense for a large, distributed, and contingent workforce. Consider a platform like TaskRabbit, for which the vast majority of workers are contingent. Such businesses rely on an initial layer of what we can think of as algorithmic management. The very design of their platforms allows them to enforce rules and create incentives for desired behavior. Customer rating systems stand in for performance reviews. Allowing workers to rate customers can maintain morale by weeding out the bad apples. Workers in traditional service roles rarely get to impose real consequences on a mean or haranguing customer. But algorithmic management alone will only go so far. Creating a human connection among workers on a vast scale will also be critical. What a network like Buurtzorg is getting right is structuring for peer accountability and learning, which lightens the management burden and adds a powerful sense of shared endeavor. Gig economy platforms are shaping expectations about work and working conditions, and mostly for the worse. In 2017, one such platform, Fiverr, which offers up freelance jobs and tasks that pay as little as $5, released an ad featuring a hip but exhausted-looking millennial and this wisdom. You eat a coffee for lunch? You follow through on your follow-through? Sleep deprivation is your drug of choice? You might be a doer. Fiverr says it champions lean entrepreneurs, quite literally in the case of their advertising. The press release that accompanied the ad's launch read like a sad parody of the founder feeling. The campaign positions Fiverr to seize today's emerging zeitgeist of entrepreneurial flexibility, rapid experimentation, and doing more with less. It pushes against bureaucratic overthinking, analysis paralysis, and excessive whiteboarding. In Fiverr's world, founders can look to some a little more like serfs. As Gia Tolentino observed in The New Yorker, I'd guess that plenty of the people who advertise services on Fiverr would accept some whiteboarding in exchange for employer-sponsored health insurance. Fiverr clearly fails the circle test we laid out in Chapter 6. Platforms can do better. Take the example of Care.com, the world's largest platform for caregiving. With more than 24 million members, Care.com is where millions of families in the United States and 19 other countries go to find nannies, babysitters, and elder care. Its founder, chairwoman, and CEO, Sheila Lirio Marcelo, a Filipino-American entrepreneur, had the same early incentives to squeeze her caregivers that Uber had to squeeze its drivers, but she took a longer view. Marcelo herself was raised by Filipina nannies, and she understands the importance of their being treated with dignity and respect. As she told us, "If we want to sustain this, for the long run, you have to build a business that can't be driven off the backs of low-income labour. That won't be an attractive career for these people." Instead, she chose to build a people-to-people company, championing the rights of the caregivers on her platform. She has formed a deep and unlikely partnership with iGenPoo and her National Domestic Workers Alliance, one that both sides were initially wary of. Together, Marcelo and Poo have advocated for improved treatment of domestic workers, including initiatives like the Fair Care Pledge, through which families using the care.com platform commit to fair pay and paid time off for anyone they employ. Plus, in an industry first, they have created a pooled portable benefits program that allows workers who are paid via the platform to create their own social safety net. Now they are advocating on Capitol Hill and around the world for a comprehensive care workers' bill of rights. As work becomes more tenuous, an organized voice for workers becomes even more critical. Unions continue to decline around the world, another 20th century form of affiliation that has struggled to adapt to the 21st. But new power models can help us reimagine them. A small glimpse of this is coworker.org, a platform that allows anyone to start a workplace-level campaign, with or without a union, from Starbucks baristas who agitated for more staff, to Uber drivers who fought to have tips introduced on the platform and won. As we look to the future of work, it's easy to imagine a bifurcation, the vast majority of work shaped by the financial logic of automation and the mathematical logic of the algorithm, alongside a small number of hyper-empowered founders with tremendous agency, access to capital, and capacity to innovate. But we should reject the idea that our destiny is to end up either being replaced by robots or treated like them. We believe there's a practical advantage and a moral imperative to designing platforms that prove more human, ones that offer worker protections and security, provide freedom and dignity, and release creativity and ultimately value. Chapter 12. The Future. A Full-Stack Society. Yohai Benkler is a professor at Harvard who has spent the past 20 years writing and thinking about the possibilities of technology-enabled collaboration and mass participation. He has, for most of his career, been an articulate cheerleader for the potential of the internet to distribute power, culturally, politically, and economically. His work has influenced our thinking greatly. In the distant days of 2006, when Facebook was just a toddler, Benkler got into an argument that would grow into a big bet about the future, and would also sound a little like the title of a Robert Ludlum novel. It became known as the Carr-Benkler Wager. It all began with some strong words. Nicholas Carr, the technology writer and commentator, posted a somewhat snarky response to Benkler's then-recent book, The Wealth of Networks, in which Benkler anticipated a wave of non-market-based cooperation and productive collaboration, which translates roughly as people creating things together for reasons other than financial reward. Wikipedia and open-source software are good examples. Benkler predicted that this kind of peer production was going to become a lot more common in a hyper-connected age. Carr was having none of it. He described Benkler's book as a techno-anarcho-utopian magnum opus, and you could almost taste his disdain in the hyphens. Instead of Benkler's peer-produced paradise, Carr anticipated a much different future. He saw this open sourcing and collaboration, this hyper-friendly communalism, as part of a predictable and inevitable process of amateur activities springing up in the wake of the invention of a new communication medium, only to be followed by increasing professionalization and commercialization. The debate was a clash between Benkler's new power vision, that the huge opportunities in peer production afforded by connectivity would come to dominate the internet, and Carr's old power conviction that the forces of capitalism and managerialism would reassert themselves. Collaborate versus capture. so Benkler proposed a challenge to test their opposing ideas. We could decide to appoint between 1 and 3 people who, on some date certain, survey the web or blogosphere and seek out the most influential sites in some major category, for example, relevance and filtration, like Dig, or visual images, like Flickr. And they will then decide whether they are peer production processes or whether they are price incentivized systems. 5 years later, the moment of truth arrived. Who had won the Carr Benkler wager? You may not be greatly surprised to hear that both men thought they had won. In May 2012, Carr declared victory with the marvelously titled blog post, "Pay Up, Yohai Benkler," underlining his view that the dominant production systems in most online media categories are commercial ones. Benkler retaliated a week later with a post of his own. For investors, no less than for social innovators and activists, the place to be is in sites that build platforms for social interaction and engagement, not places that figure out how to pay for the best content. Carr fired back, citing music production and distribution, news reporting, video, e-books, games, apps, and many more as examples of the triumph of corporate consolidation over peer collaboration. He ceded photographs and encyclopedias to Benkler, and, probably wisely, demurred on pornography. From peer production to participation farms. More than a decade after it was made, the wager remains unsettled. They both turned out to be more than a little right. Carr was certainly correct that peer-to-peer activity online would become more commercialized and professionalized. The early flourish of something like Couchsurfing.com, an authentic, often charmingly ramshackle sharing platform for travelers in which no money changed hands, fell by the wayside with the rise of price-based options like Airbnb. But Benkler was ahead of his time in anticipating the huge and unpaid peer production that drives the models of everything from Facebook to activist movements. Yet we can also see that the even unpaid peer production models Benkler held up so hopefully have concentrated huge wealth and power in the hands of the owners of these platforms. The content we generate creates enormous value for powerful intermediaries that gobble up our data, opaquely decide what content we get to view, and claim the lion's share of the riches that result. There are honourable exceptions, like Wikipedia, but non-profit, non-extractive models like this are not the norm. And in the meantime, those paid models Carr anticipated that would reward our productive contributions are increasingly accused of using their scale and leverage to exploit those they pay for their efforts. Uber drivers are hardly being professionalized. Indeed, Uber is doing everything it can to resist treating them as employees, as we've seen. In some senses, you might say the Carr-Benkler wager has turned out to be lose-lose. When we paid a visit to Benkler at his office at Harvard Law School, he seemed a little glum. "I'm thrilled that you're writing this optimistic book in 2017, he told us. "I think it's genuinely harder to write such a book today than it was 10 years ago." To explain why, he describes a class he teaches every few years on the music industry and intellectual property. What's interesting is that if you teach the case of the music industry in the late 2000s, what you see is radical decentralization and breakup. When you teach it 5 years ago, it's the beginning of the emergence of mid-level structures to allow artists to make a living. Voluntary donations, SoundCloud. Then you're teaching it in 2016, and it's basically all Spotify. It's completely re-centralized. You can imagine Carr rubbing his hands together in self-righteous glee. As consumers, who are well-trained to value the frictionless over almost all else, we all benefit from having easier-to-use services like Spotify, especially those of us who can remember failing to work out how to download obscure Tracy Chapman tracks on Napster. Yet the price of this is that we are all locked into a handful of platforms that keep consolidating and making it harder for us to disentangle ourselves from them. Just think of how Facebook eats up potential competitors like Instagram and WhatsApp so it can create one big ecosystem we depend on. And those creating the value on these platforms are squeezed. YouTube creators, Benkler reminds us, now have to sign over the rights to their catalogue to the company in order to share in the revenues their content creates. The new power models that were a mere twinkle in Benkler's eye a decade ago have grown big and have become increasingly decoupled from the new power values their founders espoused.